Welcome to DevMode.fm, a podcast dedicated to the tools, techniques, and technologies used in modern web development. I'm Andrew Welch from NY Studio 107.
I'm Patrick Harrington from Mildly Geeky in Boston.
I'm Jonathan Melville from MDD in Atlanta.
I'm Marian Nulevant here in Portland, Oregon.
And today we have on Ben Orenstein from Tuple. How you doing, Ben?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
No worries. So we're having you on to talk about pair programming with Tuple, or in this day and age of COVID-19, you know, lots more people are doing kind of the remote working thing. And I would imagine that that has been an interesting time for you with Tuple. And we'll get into that in just a second. But we got to figure out exactly what this Tuple thing is. So if you were sitting with a friend of yours in Cusco, Peru, and you're eating a quay and drinking mate coca, and your friend turns to you and says, you know, hey, what is Tuple anyway? What would you tell him?
Well, I'm pretty sure he would say Tuple.
I'm pretty sure
that would be the pronunciation in Peru, I think.
Yeah. Okay.
I would tell him that it is an app for doing remote pair programming on Mac OS.
That's good. And you're enjoying your Qui, I mean, which is wonderful. You know what Qui is? You ever had that before?
I have not, no.
Qui is guinea pig, and it's a speciality in there, so you're dying to get into it, so it's good that you were kind of pithy with it. But let's just have that conversation.
Okay.
Let's just get it out of the way. Is it Tuple or Tuple? Like, what is it?
Okay. So as far as...
Or Tuple.
Yeah. As far as like English words go, both are correct. Those are both legit pronunciations.
Mm-hmm. But how do you...
We say Tuple.
Okay. You say Tuple. However, the computer science definition of the word...
No.
And the pronunciation that I found everywhere else is Tuple. But just to be contrarian, I'm going to go with the Chipotle pronunciation and call it Tuple.
Okay, sure. Whatever floats your boat.
Yeah, we'll go with Tuple. So what is Tuple? Or sorry, I'm going to try to say this. I'm going to try really hard to say this. I'm just apologizing right now, Ben. I'm going to say
it
wrong.
Don't even correct yourself. It's fine.
Okay.
It's fine.
So Tuple. So explain to people, why don't I just use, you know, like daily.co or whereby, which used to be a peer.in, or any number of these other video sharing tools. Like, why don't I just use that? Why do I need a specialized tool for pair programming?
Well, I mean, you don't really. You can definitely get by with those tools. And the reality is that almost all of our customers are coming from some other tool. So they've been getting by with something like Zoom or Slack or Awareby or something like that.
Yep.
So you can do pair programming with some of those tools. The area where we differ is primarily around remote control. So we offer like full keyboard and mouse remote control. So it's like you're sitting next to me and you've actually plugged in your own set of inputs. And we've invested a lot of effort in things that programmers care about that the average public doesn't care about. So there's that remote control piece, which we think is important for pairing. But then there's also lots of little UX things and trade-offs we've made. So for example, we prioritize using less CPU than you might otherwise, because we know developers are doing things like running Docker containers or, you know, compiling things. And CPU is a precious resource. So we just, our fundamental thesis was, if we went after pair programming as a particular niche, like if we made that our use case, and we just made all these decisions, architectural decisions, UX decisions, that we would be able to make something that was much more pleasant to pair program with that generic tool.
It's really evident. I mean, so I have been using Tuple for quite some time, or not quite some time, but I learned about it originally from kind of friend of the show, Adam Watham.
And all right. Yeah.
He may not be friends with us, but we're friends with him. So, no, I'm kidding. We've had Adam on a number of times. He's a great guy. But I heard about it from him, and I'm like, all right, you know, I'm going to go check this thing out. And I tried it. And my favorite thing about it is when I first connected, like there was no Chrome. Like it was just, I saw their screen and it was just there and it was super clear. Like it wasn't as kind of muddy or nasty as some of these other screen sharing tools that I've used before, you know?
Totally. Yeah. So like those two decisions are very good examples. So like the Chrome thing was big for us because I've used Zoom a fair amount and it's got that bar that you have to like drag around and constantly like kind of gets in the way. And that always drove me crazy. And so we're like, okay, no UI Chrome. We're going to tuck everything up into the little menu bar app. And then also Clarity is a big one. So almost all video conferencing things are built around sharing faces.
Right.
And it turns out you can have a pretty low resolution and still understand someone's expressions and such. Mm-hmm. But if you take those same settings and then try to push screen pixels through it, it makes it pretty hard to read code. And often developers have a ton of text on the screen and this text is fairly small and every little detail matters. Like a less than is very different than a greater than in our world. So we crank up the quality quite a bit at the expense of some bandwidth because we think it's important for our use case.
And I would imagine that in order to, and we'll nerd out a little bit, but I would imagine that in order to get this kind of efficiency, you're probably hooking into the Windows server, because I know that it will give you a diff and it will show you like just the areas that changed on the screen. Are you doing that? You're then just sending along just the area that it says changed?
That's right. Yep. Yeah. We're basically shipping diffs over the wire. And then every so often it will do what's called a keyframe, which is it gets the whole screen just to make sure in case something weird has happened, you have like a fresh version.
Yep.
But then in between it's trying to send like very minimal things such that if stuff is not changing on your screen, we use almost no bandwidth because there's just nothing to send.
Yeah, and I know this because in a former life, I wrote a video capture program for the Mac, and it does the same thing, right? Where whenever something changes on the screen, there's a debugging tool you can use to turn this on so you can see like the changed areas of the screen, but it would take just the area that changed and send along just that diff. And like you said, if nothing's happening, it's not doing anything, right? That's pretty awesome.
It is nice. It's great to see like the CPU usage and the bandwidth just like fall off, just drop down when not much is going on.
Yeah. And one of the other fun features that I've really liked and always surprises people when they connect the first time, like I have connected with Jonathan and done some pair stuff with him. One of the things that we like doing is the fact that you can draw on the screen. So when someone shares their screen with you and you're kind of observing it, by default, you have a pen tool that you can use, right? You remember that, Jonathan, the first time we connected?
Yeah, I was going to say some of us enjoy doing that more than others.
Well, yeah. Okay. So yeah.
I'll look over at my screen. It'll just have scribbles all over it.
Well, when we're waiting for like Webpack to build or Docker Compose to do its thing, right. Like, you know, what are we going to do? But it is, I do like that, Ben. I like that I can just kind of like doodle on there. You know,
it's fun.
I do have another person that unfortunately is a guest that couldn't make it, Matt, that I've connected with. And Matt, unfortunately, like has drawn some not so friendly things on my screen when we're sharing. Like I don't know if you've seen American Vandal, but he drew a phallus on my screen. Is there?
I see.
That doesn't sound like Matt.
I'm going to tell you
what. I absolutely had it coming.
Yeah.
I can. So I'm gonna share a little known pro tip here.
Yeah.
Which is almost a secret feature, which is if someone's drawing on your screen, if you double click on the paint, it will clear it.
Oh, that's beautiful. I can prevent Matt from doing his dastardly deeds. That's fantastic.
Yeah, that's basically an Easter egg. So enjoy.
Well, no, but it really is. Like, I love the fact, like half of the time when you're doing these guided things, you're like, no, over there. Like, no, click over there. And it's so nice to just be able to draw a circle and be like, here.
Yeah. You know? Sometimes I'll even catch myself like pointing at my screen. Trying to tell them as if they can see me. So the ability to just like circle something in the sidebar of the IED that you're trying to refer to, I mean, it just instantly gets rid of that friction.
Mm-hmm. Yep, totally.
And I'm used to, you know, when I've had products to do support to, you do the arrows that point to like the thing, you know? And I find myself doing that all the time too, where I just do like an arrow, like over there, you know, this is the thing that we need to be paying attention to.
Totally.
Totally. So I have a question about the pricing of this thing. So how does the pricing work? Because I signed up for this thing back when there was like a freelancer pricing and then there was something else and it was kind of confusing. I honestly have no idea what I picked, but it looks like the pricing model has changed. How does it work now?
Yeah, that's so you're right that it was confusing. It was a thing. So we have basically been testing various pricing schemes over the months, and we're pretty settled on where we are now. And hopefully it's a little less confusing, but could still probably use a little bit of tweaking. But the basically the way it works is paid users cost $25 per user per month.
Mm-hmm.
And paid users can pair with anyone. You can add guest users for free. So if you have a paid account, you can add 20 people, none of whom have to pay. They can all pair with you because you're paid, but they can't pay with each other.
Okay.
So basically at least one person on a call has to have a paid account.
Right. So, but only one, right? So if I had a client that I needed to see what was going on, I could have them install Tuple. They could share their screen and we can just go from there, right?
Exactly. Yep. And we have a fair number of consultancies that have rotating cast of clients using it. And that's exactly what they do.
Yeah. So it's $25 a month. I don't have to worry about who. Now, does it matter who initiates the screen share?
Nope.
So it makes no difference. I could share with them. They could share with me. As long as one person on the call has a paid account, that's all we need to worry about.
That's exactly right. Yep.
Yeah, that's
fantastic. And you can swap during the call. Like you can share your screen, then they can, without even starting a new call, just start sharing theirs.
I would suggest updating the copy on your website to say basically that. right? Just
yeah.
As long as one person on the call has a paid account, you're good. Because that's where I was confused about.
Yep.
I'm
making a note. I'll do that.
Yeah.
Well, it does say pair with external collaborators for free.
It does. But the thing I was confused about is I thought that that meant that they could share their screen, but I couldn't share mine.
Oh.
You know,
it's,
you know, so making it clear that all that matters to get full functionality is that one person has a paid account. I think
that makes sense.
Would at least, it would at least clear it up for me. I may just be being a dummy, you know, but it,
no.
Yeah.
This is a common confusion point. And this has actually been one of the interesting learnings of building a business is that things you think are clear are not that clear.
Well, because you're like, too close to the product.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep. Totally.
You know how it works, but you're, you know, other people are approaching it and they're, you know, they don't know. They're not in your head, thank God.
They don't even know how to pronounce the name of the product.
Right? Yeah, I know. It's horrible. Well, that makes it really awesome. So I've got an additional question based on that. And I'm not going to make the whole show just about me like getting my answers. Don't worry.
Sure, no problem.
But is there a way, like let's say Jonathan and I are, or Patrick and I are sharing a screen, because Patrick and I have used this thing too, just for a couple minutes to test it out. Let's say he's sharing his screen and I want to say, no, let me show you. Is there some way we can switch, or do we have to disconnect? Yes. And okay, so how do we switch?
Up in the menu bar app, you can just go click, there's a button called start sharing.
Yep.
And that will swap who's sharing screens.
Oh. So that's nice. I didn't even know that could happen. You know, we honestly have been doing what I was saying, like we've been disconnecting and reconnecting.
Yeah. this is just more of the same thing where it's like it's not always obvious how to use the thing. Like people actually email us semi-regularly and ask for features that we already have that we're just doing a bad job of surfacing.
Yeah. Well, that's very common. I mean, I sell product as well, and it's super common that that is what you run into, you know, but that's great though. I mean, from your point of view, that's an education problem. It's not that you have to devote engineering time to actually fix or enhance the product. You already thought of it. You just have to communicate it to them better.
Right. Or make it more obvious in the UI. Like it would be nice if it wasn't education, if like no education was even required.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Maybe even like some quick, I don't know if you already had this, but something like some quick little screencast or something like getting started with Tuple. Like this just sort of explains, you know, where some of these little features are tucked.
Do you watch those when you start a new product?
I always do, actually. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm a big fan. Yeah.
If they're built into the product, I do. So if it's something where once it's installed, it says, hey, I'm installed. Do you want me to show you how to do it? Then I totally do, because it's right then and there. If it's something that I have to go back to their website, find where it is, click it to then watch it, it's kind of shaky in terms of whether
also
that
too I usually when I see the player I look at how long the video is. If it's like a 7-minute video, I'll totally watch it.
Yeah.
If it's 20 minutes, I won't.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's true. Be respectful of people's time. Yeah.
So, yeah.
So I have a very basic question.
Yeah.
It's pair programming, but can you do triple programming and quad programming?
That's a good question, actually. You can do triples. So you can add a third person as an observer to a call.
What?
Which is another feature that a lot of people don't happen to know about that they ask us for.
Okay.
This is great. This is exposing all of our poor discoverability.
This thing's feature packed and we didn't even know.
My God, I feel so dumb.
I'm so glad this is happening.
I feel so dumb.
Live on the air.
How do I
do it? No. No, this is our fault. So on a call, if you click the menu bar app, there's a little person icon with a plus next to it.
Uh-huh.
And if you do that, you can add a third person.
Oh my God. See, here's why I never even looked to try and do that, is everywhere in your verbiage, this is about pair programming. So well, I may be kind of slow. I may not know how to pronounce tuple or tuple, but I know that a pair is two, you know?
Right, yes.
So I never even looked for it, you know?
Yeah, that's fair. And to be honest, our strength is the one-to-one.
Mm-hmm.
So when you add the third person, it's actually somewhat limited. So the third person is an observer, and they can't do remote control right now.
Right,
It's honestly a thing that we built because people were screaming for it. And so we're like, what's the MVP version of this that we can ship? And so we did this, and it's nice if two of you are working on a feature and you want to bring in a third person as kind of like a, hey, can you just confirm this works? Or can you just answer a question here? And then that person drops off the call. It's not as good for three programmers that want to take turns driving.
Right.
So we don't talk it up very much because it is a bit limited, but we do eventually want to come back and give it its proper due.
Oh my God, I'm so glad that Marion asked that, because I mean, a tuple after all, I mean, it's just an ordered sequence of elements, right? There's no limit to the number of elements in a tuple, right? So
and if you say tuple, it sounds like two people, but if you say tuple, it just sounds like it could be any number.
That's true. Yeah. Hmm. You guys might have to think, you might have some rebranding going on behind the scenes.
Oh, no. We have too much to do already.
No, so that
introducing Tuple, the app formerly known as Tuple.
That would be hilarious. Oh, if you did a big media rollout and you were just
That's
like,
actually kind of a great idea.
It is a great idea because everyone runs into these here's the funny thing. So in programming, especially because in programming, we're used to reading a word a lot, but rarely saying it out loud. You know what I mean? Especially totally. If you're working on your own. So I encounter this all the time. And I just have like a handicap when it comes to pronouncing words, right? But it would be hilarious if you did a big media rollout and you were like Tuple, formerly known as Tuple.
Or the other way around, you know, depending where you want to end up.
Yeah. Just don't go with Tuple because that's going to really confuse people, I think. So I just want to let everyone know who might be listening to this that if you are used to using one of the screen sharing tools like Zoom or, you know, Whereby, which used to be called Appear.in, which was an awesome name, by the way. Whereby is kind of lame. Or Daily or any of these other kind of screen sharing things. Tuple really is pretty amazing in terms of it does what you want when you are doing pair programming, where you want to show people how stuff works, because you just click it, it's sharing your screen for you, and it just gets completely out of your way. Like there's nothing going on that interferes with it. And even on the viewing end, like you just see it in a window and you can mark it up, you can take control, which I think is super important. A lot of these other tools are kind of frustrating because they don't let you circle something or draw an arrow there, or more importantly, take control, right, Ben?
Yeah, absolutely. And honestly, this is great. I feel like I should have you do a case study for us because you're selling the product very well.
Well, I will do a case study. I mean, so whenever we have someone on the show to talk about a product, it's always something that I use and it's always something that I like and use, because I'm not going to have someone on and talk about a product that I used it and it sucks and just spend like an hour trashing them, right? Like, what's the point?
Yeah.
Right? I mean,
that would be cool.
That would be a great episode, actually.
I mean, not for them.
It'd be like American Idol, where they just trash the bad singer.
Yeah. Would anyone go on that podcast? Like, if you had a podcast called like "What Were You Thinking," and you would like just like blast people about their bad product decisions, would anyone be a guest? I don't know.
If it was really good feedback, I might do it because it's basically like an audio version of Shark Tank.
Right.
Yeah. Compression engine episode going.
Yeah.
What are you thinking? Sort of the no publicity is bad publicity.
Yeah. I think like people would like to listen to it, but I wonder if you could get anyone to go on knowing what it was.
It would basically be like fraternity hazing, you know? I mean, like it's just it would be kind of brutal. But no, seriously, I think it's important to mention because there are lots of tools out there that will let you basic share a screen for free, right? They don't cost anything. Mm-hmm. But what you're doing with Tuple is so much better when it comes to pair programming. And the best thing I can say about the lack of CPU usage is I have never noticed when Tuple is running.
Mm,
and that is not awesome. The case with a lot of these other programs that just slow things down to a crawl. And yeah, like when if you're doing a screen share and you're trying to show someone like how to run Webpack inside of Docker and like you're spinning up all of this crap, their machine is just going to start crying for mercy. You know, like the fans are going to kick in and they're going to drown out any audio that you might have.
Well, when you were talking earlier about how a lot of people who come to Tuple were getting by with other tools. So that's exactly what it felt like to me. Getting by is exactly how I would describe it. So I'm a huge fan of Zoom. I still use Zoom every day. And I guess we were using Zoom for this purpose before, but it did always kind of feel like, well, we're kind of shoehorning this tool into this situation to make it work, but it doesn't quite feel right. Tuple was completely different in that it removed all of the pain points of trying to use something like Zoom or Whereby. It was just zero friction. I didn't even really think about like the CPU impact, but now that I think about it, it is considerably less. So yeah, just removing all of the friction from the process is the clear selling point.
That's great to hear. That was something we kind of did accidentally, but it worked. Turned into a bigger deal than we thought it was, which is since Tuple lives up in your menu bar, like where your clock and sound controls are and Wi-Fi, you're basically two clicks from being on a pairing session with someone. And so there's no invite link. So people say that it feels lightweight to them. And because also like when running it, there's no Chrome and there's low CPU. So the experience is just like, oh, it's not a big deal to hop on a pairing session with someone.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that feeling was not something we were explicitly shooting for, but like now that we have it, people talk about it a lot. Like they refer to it as lightweight.
Yeah.
And so we know now.
And if you're already working on a complicated problem, like that's going to be frustrating enough, like to have the added frustration of like, you can't make your idea clear because you can't quite see what's going on or mm-hmm. it's a little laggy or whatever. It just makes the process so much more frustrating.
Totally.
That actually reminds me of the weight of calling someone versus texting someone. Like mm-hmm. these days mm-hmm. to me, like if I get a call from someone, like that's like a big deal.
You're like,
you know
oh,
what I mean?
God,
like it's a either something really bad is happening or, you know, just something really important and it's very disruptive. Mm-hmm. Whereas a text is just like whatever. Like, you know, I would actually for most things prefer that people text me. And it is that kind of weight difference, at least in my mind, between tuple and something like an arranged Zoom meeting, between a telephone call and a text. You know what I mean? So like mm-hmm. it's happened many times that either I've had a problem or Jonathan's had a problem or whatever. Patrick's had an issue. And like we just connect real quick, talk it through, solve it, and then disconnect. That's all, you know?
Perfect. Yeah.
Like get in, get out. I can't finish that song because our podcast is the rating will go down, Marin. We don't want that, right?
We definitely
it's
don't
the clock.
Want that.
11:30.
Yeah.
It
is.
In any event, a question that I had about this is, what about a Windows client? I'm sure that you get this all the time. Maybe to a lesser extent, you get questions about a Unix client. What about it?
Well, here's the first weird thing, which is that we actually get way more requests for a Linux client than Windows.
Hmm. What?
And it's actually about 2-1.
Wow. It doesn't seem too surprising to me.
So
it's shocking to me.
Yeah. So here's my theory. So the market of developers is basically 50% Windows, 25% Mac, 25% Linux, roughly.
Mm-hmm.
So it is weird to get so many Linux requests, but I think it's actually a result of the fact that we started on Mac. Because Mac is a Unix at heart. And so it's not a huge jump to go from Mac OS to something like Ubuntu, for example.
Mm.
So I think it's actually, we're seeing people that kind of like jumped ship from Mac OS perhaps and over to Linux.
I have another theory.
Okay.
And the theory is that there are plenty of solutions for Windows, but there aren't that many solutions for Linux at all.
Right.
You may be right about the jumping ship thing. And some of these solutions for Windows may or may not be as good as Tuple, but there's at least a solution. Whereas on Linux, like, I don't even know, like, is there even a Zoom client? I have no idea.
I think there might be, but I'm not sure.
But I think there, if anything, there certainly are going to be fewer. So it may be a scarcity of resources kind of thing where, you know, that's maybe why. But yeah, it also makes sense that some people that were Mac developers ended up kind of bailing and going over there. But so, all right. So forget about how many requests you have. Like,
sure.
Are you going to do one?
Yes, almost certainly. We are growing quite well on Mac only, but one of our top requests is, hey, I want to pair with my coworkers that have Linux machines or Windows machines. And it's a pretty clear win for us, right? Just having more potential customers, like we can 3x our possible customer base by adding those clients.
Yep.
It's also a pretty big project,
sure,
maybe even a huge project, and permanently increases the complexity of the product. Mm-hmm. So once you have like, we don't just need to test this on a few versions of Mac OS. Now we need to test like what happens when like Catalina is sharing a screen with someone on this version of Ubuntu.
Ooh,
what about
nice.
Debian? What about this version of Windows? What about when this version of Windows shares with this version of Linux? And like, you can just see how like the combinatorics explode really fast.
Mm-hmm. In theory though, if you have some kind of a standardized data stream or standardized way that the data is flowing, it shouldn't matter, right? Because either it conforms to either it conforms to the spec or it doesn't, right?
Yes. And so in theory, yeah, that sounds great. My hunch is that it's still going to be really hard. The internals are not the part that scares us. Like, so we are already in process of moving the sort of platform agnostic parts of the app into Rust, partly for safety and then partly because it's going to make it easier to go multi-platform. And then also, but there is actually a pretty complicated bit, which is the native portion. So Tuple is a native Mac app because we want all the goodness that being native brings, like speed and feeling like a real part of the operating system the current system. And so there are going to be, I think, a lot of UX challenges when we start adding another native app in other platforms where it's like, oh, they don't have the concept of a menu bar in Windows, or they don't, or it's different. It works differently. We're not allowed to do these things, or there's no API for this over here. So I think it's going to be less around the video codecs and connection negotiation. I expect that to all be basically the same. It's going to be like, how do you make another really good feeling native app, especially in platforms that we don't have as much experience with?
Well, all right. So first of all, Ben, tell the truth in terms of adopting Rust for this thing. Are you at least in part doing it just because you want to start learning Rust because it's kind of cool?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, I'm actually not the one writing Rust, so this is our CTO, Spencer, who's been leading that charge. Mm-hmm. And he, part of it is definitely like motivation. Like, we didn't start a company to make a job that we hate for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So part of the motivation is definitely like, this is fun. It's more fun than C++. If we're going to have to write millions of lines of this thing or whatever, or work on it for years, let's have it be in a language that we like working in. Well, it also, I think, increases our ability to recruit people well.
Mm.
Like, there are fewer Rust developers than C++ developers, but there are lots of people that want to become Rust developers.
Mm-hmm.
And so having having a more attractive technology, I think, is kind of actually like a recruiting play in a way.
Yeah. And I think, if you know that someone's interested in Rust, like, they're interested for all the right reasons, they're probably someone you want anyway.
Totally.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah, I've been messing with the rustling stuff for a while, like just kind of working my way through it. It's weird. Like, I did the whole, back when I was doing a whole lot of C programming, mm-hmm. I looked at C++, but I ended up just not using it at all. And I was doing Objective-C stuff and then Swift stuff, but I just kind of skipped the whole C++ thing. Like, I looked at it, and actually when it first came out, I don't think it still is, but it used to be just a preprocessor for the GCC compiler. And when it first came out, like,
it was kind of bad, and it isn't anymore.
It's not anymore?
Okay. No, it hasn't been for a while, but it certainly made it a horrible language. So I'm going to expose my ignorance and say, what is Rust? Is Rust one of these Java-like languages, only way better, or is it something else?
Oh, it's so much cooler. I'll let Ben tell you. Go ahead, Ben.
Well, I mean, I'm kind of the tech-ignorant CEO at this point, so you might have a better summary than I do.
Okay, so Rust is closer to being analogous to C than it would be to Java, I would say. But it does give you memory safety. It's got a very, very interesting scheme for handling that, as well as it gives you thread safety. So it's something that actually a lot of system level programmers are looking at, in terms of they get the low level, they get the speed, it's a very minimal runtime, but they also don't have to deal with, they do have to get their mind around the memory and thread safety model that is in there, because it is kind of unique. And I'll be honest with you, my head is not fully around it yet. But once you do that, you're then able to write system level code without having to worry about a lot of these threading issues and memory issues that if you're doing it in C or C++, you have to.
By memory issues, is that garbage collection or?
Memory issues in terms of, you know, just dumb stuff, like, you know, being able to write beyond the boundary of something, or who owns something, or, you know, one thread is stomping on another thread's memory, you know, that type of thing. It takes care of the ownership chunk of memory.
Mm-hmm.
It still is not, I don't believe it's a garbage collection language, but I could be wrong on that. But I think it's more that it has a methodology in place for who owns what,
mm-hmm.
and only one thing can be doing something with it at a time. And Rust is something that, the reason I actually got interested in it and started learning it, is it's a really, really good way to build WebAssembly stuff, because the Mozilla team did a really nice job making sure that Rust is good for that, right? For building, as a source language for building WebAssembly stuff. But then also, like, Microsoft apparently is looking at adopting it system-wide, just to make some of the issues that they run into as an operating system developer, you know, kind of more easy to deal with.
Okay. Is it like C, a compiled language?
Yes. It's a compiled language, and it does have a runtime, but it's a minimal runtime. It's not like Go, where you're going to get this positively massive runtime that comes along with it. The cost in Rust, at least from what I have seen so far, is just learning the paradigm that it uses.
Okay. I have a
and
feeling
we should do,
we've gotten off topic here, but it's a fascinating topic to me.
We're way off topic, but we should totally at some point do a podcast on Rust.
Yeah, and I'll put in one more.
Who knows more than me.
I'll put in one more plug for it, which is when Stack Overflow does their annual developer survey, which they get a lot of responses for, so I think is reasonably representative. And they ask developers, what is your most loved language? Rust has won the last 3 years.
Oh, wow.
So it's a language that makes people very happy.
Those three people using it must have voted like a whole lot of time.
Exactly. You can write a very fast automatic voter in Rust, multi-threaded, and it won't crash.
That's actually a great point. Like, they should have that vote thing, and then whoever can write the most efficient bot that clicks it wins, right?
There you go.
Why not? Yeah.
Why not? Hmm. What could go wrong?
So any So anyway, like we're talking about, you know, you were refactoring it to Rust as part of your transition to allow you to build this for multiple platforms. The reason why I think that is super important for you as a company is when organizations look at adopting this tool, they want something that they can use site-wide,
right?
In order for that to be the case, it has to work on Windows, right? I mean, Linux is going to be a concern in some places, but it at the very least has to cover Windows and probably should cover every type of machine that the people in their organization are running. And this is super important for you folks as a company because a lot of your revenue is going to come from these enterprise licenses, and they want a solution where they buy it and everyone can use it.
Sure.
I've actually talked to some people at organizations and tried to get them to adopt Tuple. You're welcome.
I appreciate that.
But they said that they needed something that would work with their Windows clients as well.
Got it.
And therefore they weren't going to buy it.
Yeah, I'm not shocked. That's probably one of the biggest reasons that we lose opportunities like that right now. Mm-hmm. So it's pros and cons, right? Like it makes our development life easier because we're on one platform, but it does mean that the size of the deals that we can go after is probably limited a bit.
Yeah, and it's funny, like an organization could have, you know, let's say 90% Macs, 10% Windows, and the organization rules still will not allow them to get this tool, you know, for their developers, potentially. And it depends on the organization. Mm-hmm. But they're always looking for universal solutions, right? They want just the fewer the vendors, the fewer the paperwork, the fewer the times they have to push the PO through, the less hassles, you know?
Totally. Yep. Yeah, my hope is that we start these alternative clients like late this year. It's a hand wavy, we'll see. And like the world is changing rapidly, so our priorities have already rejiggered, but that's kind of my rough timeline.
Yeah, so I mean, let's just talk about the elephant in the room. We're all in the midst of the COVID-19 virus that is going crazy everywhere. So if anyone in the future is listening to this and half of humanity is gone, or you know, you're living in an end of days situation. We're all alive and well now, but I would imagine that the surge in people working from home might have had some kind of an impact on your business.
Yes, that's definitely true. Part of the reason we started the company was because we figured that remote work was going to become more and more popular. And so there'd be more and more people working from home. Mm-hmm. And this is basically that, but accelerated by a lot and more or less enforced by government mandate.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, we've basically usage has kind of gone off the chart over the last couple of weeks. And so
I saw that I got the email from you guys. I guess it was, I can't remember if it was last week or 2 weeks ago, about the issue where you couldn't see your friends online or something. Was that a result of like the sudden surge of people using it?
Okay. Yeah. In particular, one of our biggest customer was already using it quite a bit, and then basically told everyone to go work from home and said, here's one way to keep connecting. And they just added hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of users in an incredibly short period of time. Mm. And we had a bit of a poison pill. We'd basically, like, for expediency's sake, done a pretty naive algorithm in part of the showing who was online, and it totally worked until you hit a certain number of users, and then it started backing up horribly and sort of expanding exponentially. So everything was fine, and we knew we had made this trade-off, and then all of a sudden, within like an hour, it was not at all fine, and we had to sort of scramble to pay down that previous choice.
So hold on. So instead of reaching a tipping point, all your customers reached a tuple point?
Sure.
Awful. We can edit that out.
Yeah, please.
Okay, yeah, that was pretty bad. We can edit that out. Okay, so hundreds of more customers being added quickly. That's great, because that also means like a lot more money coming in, doesn't it?
Yes, it's a nice time to actually be charging money for something and not being like a freemium model or like just a VC-backed, we'll figure out money later kind of thing.
Right.
So with this, the growth, we've been able to, first of all, invest in better infrastructure, of course, just, you know, bump up the Heroku sizes and whatnot, no problem. Mm-hmm. But also do a little bit of hiring. So we actually just hired our first engineer who's going to be working part-time with us for a while, but we're excited to be expanding the team and getting some more knowledge in here.
That's fantastic. So I would think that this would be an amazing opportunity that you could leverage all that money coming in to put it towards building the Mac and the Linux clients, right? Like use this windfall to push the product forward.
Yeah, totally. That's definitely been on our minds.
So do you have a release date that you would like to announce now?
Oh yeah, that sounds like a great idea.
I'm glad you agree. So what is the release date?
Yeah. I've decided I have a new personal policy, which is to not commit to dates in public basically ever again. Because so far, every time I've done it, I have regretted it.
Yep.
Even when I name a date that I'm pretty like that, I'm just like, oh, there's no way this will be a problem. I still have come back.
So basically, what you're telling us is June 2020.
So, you know, 2020, first quarter, second quarter, third quarter, fourth quarter, fifth quarter, sixth quarter.
It's going to be it's going to be during a quarter. I can promise that.
Yeah, all right.
So, Marion, maybe you'll agree with me because you and I are like the old timers of the group. So I remember it was probably like 20 or 30 years ago that we adopted the policy that we were never announcing release dates again. And I just think it's hilarious that everyone is constantly rediscovering this. It's not just Ben. Like I see it all over the place that people are like, yeah, we used to announce release dates, but we don't do this anymore. Right.
No. Everybody but Elon Musk.
Yeah.
It feels like there's not a lot of upside to be gained by committing to a date exactly.
Well, usually it's marketing, right? So if you are working in a decent sized company, usually the people that want a release date are the marketing people, you know? And then if you're doing that, what ends up happening is engineering is then working itself almost backwards in that it's not working on it until it's done. It's working to have the product ready for the marketing stuff that is being done. And, you know, I mean, that's one way to run a company, but if you are developer centric, it's feels wrong, you know?
Totally. Well, I don't think you should just let things go and go and go until everybody thinks they're done because,
yes,
you know, you need to not necessarily an announced hard stop, but you need to have a clear plan.
I'm in favor of Basecamp has been beating this drum recently, but sort of this idea of like, if you want to set a deadline, that's actually reasonable. It's kind of can be nice to scope the work or to set a stopping point as long as you maintain a lot of flexibility in what the scope looks like.
Right.
Yes, 100%. That's what the issue is, right? The issue is not that there's a hard and fast date necessarily. The issue is the amount of stuff that you have promised to be in there by that date.
Right.
So for the companies that are announcing dates, because there actually are valid reasons for having something on a particular release schedule, but you're 100% right, Ben. What they have to be is ruthless in terms of slashing stuff to make sure that you meet that. You know, you can't have both. Either you have a fixed date or you have all the features done. Right. It just, you know, it's one way or the other, and you figure out, you know, where the give and take is there, I think. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But the service that you ran or the service that you continue to run, is that primarily just handling the buddy list and an actual connection between two people doing a tuple share is just peer to peer, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
But so once you want to pair with someone, that is immediately peer to peer and it doesn't touch our servers, which is great, by the way. But even just the whole like showing 500 people and their online status eventually became a challenge. So we run on Heroku, and Heroku isn't really ideal for what we had, which is like thousands of persistent connections. Like they want you to make a request and then get out of there. And so we kept running into these weird issues, and like their support would be like kind of helpful, but not really. And the consensus was kind of always like, well, it's not really the best way to do this, but you can do it. And so we decided we wanted to move to a different architecture.
Yeah. Long running servers can always have issues like that with stuff accumulating. But so, okay, if you are down, let's say you're down or Heroku is down or whatever, is there any way that we can direct connect, or is that just not a thing?
It's not a thing right now. If you happen to have like a cached version of who was online, you could certainly establish connections, but we don't have like a enter somebody's IP address here or anything like that right now.
Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking that the danger there is you would never be able to auth, right? In terms of knowing that one or the other had an actual license. Yeah.
That's true. Yep. Or who you were even calling for sure.
Yeah, there could be spoofing potential. I'm just thinking like that potentially that could be nice, you know, just if there is any downtime that I could actually connect with this thing that I own, but I get it. You know, maybe the thing that could happen is it could cache that you are a valid owner or something like that, you know, so it would work for 24 hours with a direct connect or something, you know. I don't know.
Yeah. These sound like the kind of things I'll have our like seventh or eighth engineer work on.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I'm always curious about people's DevOps. So you said that you've already moved off of Heroku?
We are in the process of... So we moved our biggest customers off of Heroku for the persistent connection piece.
Okay.
Heroku still runs the back end like sign up and billing and user management. But we moved to a service called Ably.
That's which what I was going to ask what you moved to.
Yeah, they specialize in exactly this. Okay. Like they have this giant globally distributed network of servers that are meant to maintain long-running connections to thousands of customers or clients. And it was funny. I was talking to a fellow software company CEO one day, and I was like kind of complaining about the trouble we were having. And he was like, oh, he's like, WebSockets connections is something, it's like one of those things that I just always outsource to somebody else. Like, I think of it like billing. Right. Like, I'm never going to write my own billing engine, and I'm never going to manage my own connections. And I was like, wait, what?
Smart man.
You can outsource this? And he was like, yeah. He's like, there are just services that just do this. And I was like, holy crap. And so we found Ably and have been pretty happy with it so far.
Yeah, you can outsource just about anything these days, I think.
Well, it's just wonderful to find a landing page that says like, hey, we specialize in doing the thing that you do and that you hate doing and that you are not doing particularly well. It's like, oh, right. Hallelujah.
So this is an active WebSocket connection between me and your server when I'm seeing that buddy list. Is that what it is?
Currently, yes. Yep.
Does it need to be? I mean, it could just like ping every interval.
Totally. You know? Yep, it certainly could. Yeah. We went with the active connection so that you could, as soon as someone came online, you would see it, or went offline, you wouldn't be able to call them.
Right.
But if we hadn't been able to get the Ably thing working, that was going to be our fallback probably. It's just like revert to polling.
Mm. Yeah, and just have like a refresh button. You know what I mean?
Yeah, sure. Yep.
That would prevent people from freaking out and saying it's not working and that type of thing.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
So, okay, you've got a nice surge in business from the fact that more people are working at home. I'm kind of hopeful that this is going to convince companies that working from home or just a remote workplace is a viable thing.
Mm.
I have the feeling that a lot of companies are ill-prepared for it, so they may come up with the opposite opinion, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because anything done badly is going to leave it's just not going to work, right?
Mm-hmm.
And my concern is a lot of companies are just, they're being forced to go all remote and they haven't really thought it through, figured out like the right way to do it, even know like the tools or processes that they could be using to do this. But I'm still hopeful. I'm hopeful that as a result of all of this, more and more companies will be doing work remotely and using tools like Tuple when they're doing that. So far, we've been using it primarily like, I'm having a problem, help me fix this. Or let me show you how to do that. But what are some of the other benefits of doing essentially pair programming? Like for code reviews or what are some other use cases?
Oh, yeah. I'm a big fan of pairing. I became a fan when I got my first like really good dev job. I had a crappy dev job and then I found a good one. And it was at a Rails place doing a Rails app. And I sat next to my boss for, I don't know, probably 4 hours every day pairing with mm-hmm. him. And I learned so much about programming. And it wasn't just Ruby and Rails, but it was also like workflow. Like how often do you commit? And what should commit messages look like? And just all of these, and like what kind of shell aliases should you have? Like what are some useful shortcuts that you can take? And so pairing was a huge boost in my skills as a developer. And it makes sense mm-hmm. because this is like basically the apprenticeship model for programming. Like humans have been learning from other humans forever. That's like how we do it. Like watch someone else do something, do it with them, get corrected by them. It's just an awesome way to learn things. It's so
monkey see, monkey efficient. Do. That's us. We're monkeys.
Yeah, totally.
Monkey see, monkey do.
And it works. So I like pairing a lot for sharing knowledge around. And it doesn't just have to be like a senior developer pairing with a junior developer. I don't think I've ever paired with anyone and not learned at least some small thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, oh, wait, how did you do that? It's like, oh, I didn't realize there was a shortcut for that. Or I didn't know there was docs for this or whatever. So it's nice for sharing programming proficiency around. It's nice for spreading knowledge of the code base around. Hey, like, Marion, you wrote the widget creator. Could I pair with you on this? Because I have to go fix a bug in there. Like, that's useful because now I'm gonna get to learn the widget creator from you.
Oh, yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
And then also, code review after the fact is probably net good. It's good to have someone review a PR, but I find it's actually very hard to provide a lot of good feedback in a PR. Like often it's just tough to load all the context in your head to understand all the changes as a whole and to think through them. Whereas if another person and I are doing it together, we've already applied two brains to the problem and are sort of constantly peer reviewing as we go. And so by the end, I feel much less need to get that code reviewed.
I feel you on the PRs because I have some projects on GitHub that get PRs from time to time.
Yeah.
And I think people don't realize it's kind of like your cat brings a dead mouse to your door, you know? Like the cat... The cat thinks it's bringing you this awesome thing and their heart is in the right place, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But it actually can be a lot of work just to make sure that the PR isn't, because you don't know how much this other person knows about the project. You don't know the implications of the changes that they're making and all that kind of stuff. You know what I mean? Like I definitely feel you on the PR thing, you know?
Yep. Yeah. I think code review is kind of a necessary evil, but is a real cost and takes a lot of effort. Whereas pairing kind of, I think even, so you have two eyes on the problem, which means you're probably more likely to spot bugs early and issues. But there's also this nice, subtle social contract that is there, or like a little bit of pressure perhaps, where it's like, well, I don't want to write the crappy version of this because I know I'm sitting there with Patrick and like he's going to call me out if I, you know, do this lazy version as opposed to the good version.
He would definitely call you out. Yeah.
Very low tolerance.
Exactly. So I think that the code written by pairs tends to be of honestly substantially higher quality than something that you wrote solo.
Mm.
So you mentioned that you learned a ton about programming by sitting next to your boss at your non-crappy dev job, right?
Yes. Yep.
The same way that you learned by that monkey see, monkey do thing, getting back to what we were talking about before in terms of having some videos showing us how Tuple works, allow us to learn the same way. You know what I mean?
Totally.
And at least for me, and again, it may be just because I'm lazy or whatever, but I am much more likely to view some of these videos if it's embedded into the actual app itself. You know, because if it's right there, it's like, hey, we see you just set this up. Like, do you want to see how it works? I'll be like, yeah, sure. If I got to go back to the website, find the tutorial videos, like I just may not even do that. I may just fumble around and never know that I can switch. So in the same way that you were able to watch his workflow, just in like a 5-minute video of you tuple sharing with somebody else and doing stuff like, oh, wow, they switched screens. I didn't know you could do that. Oh, wow, they added a third person. That's how you do that. You know
totally.
What I mean?
Yeah, that's a great idea. We should totally do that.
Yeah, I would think that would be fantastic from a monkey see, monkey do perspective, because it sounds like there's a lot of functionality that, you know, I know I'm not the brightest bulb, but I didn't even know I've been using Tuple for a while. No. I didn't even know that it could do some of this, you know?
Totally, yeah. Did you know about audio only calls, by the way?
I did not. I don't think it's something I would probably do that often, although it might be useful from like a, you know, like using it as a glorified CB, I guess. Well, so, what's the use case for that?
So one nice thing is, sometimes you start a call and you don't know who's going to actually drive. So I can just call you and we can talk. Okay. And it's like, why don't you share? Yep. And you go, okay. And then you can add the screen share to that call.
Got it.
Can you schedule like a tuple session with somebody?
You can't, right? Like, we don't have any schedule integration right now. Like, you could certainly do it through other tools, but we don't have like a send an invite or something like that.
Right.
Well, you can always use whatever your existing calendar is and just
it's not that big of a deal. I was just curious since we had discovered a few features we didn't know about earlier.
Sure.
And I do have something that would be really useful. So something Jonathan and I were doing recently was we were setting a bunch of people up using a new kind of base framework for a project that we had designed, right? So we have myself, we have Jonathan, and we have three or four other people that are kind of in the line. We ended up using Zoom for this. I would have loved to have used Tuple for this, but first of all, I didn't know that you could add more than two people to it, but can you add an arbitrary number of observers, or is it capped at three, or how does that work?
Yeah, you're capped at three total people.
Yeah. Well, I mean, for what it's worth, as something that could potentially be useful in the future, I don't know if it's doable with a peer-to-peer, because that, you know, starts to break down. I don't know.
Right.
Like, maybe, I don't think Zoom is peer-to-peer. I think it goes through their server.
I think that's correct. I mean, it must once you reach a certain number of participants, at least.
It has to, because it's not going to scale. But just for situations like that where, you know, we wanted to share, I think it would have been really useful.
Yeah, so that's actually one of our, like, most requested features right now is better mobbing support, which is a nice sign. Like, people are saying, like, we like it. We just want to use it with more people. So it's like, hey, that's cool. I'll take that.
Yeah.
So it's mobbing is kind of like multi-platform, and that it is a big complexity increase, but you know, it's something that we're going to do both those things.
And maybe an architecture change, right?
Oh, definitely an architecture change. Yeah, because right now it's peer-to-peer, and then if you add a third person, we basically establish a mesh network, and the mesh breaks down pretty fast once you add more people past three. So we're going to have to move to a new architecture where you kind of stream into a server, and that server sort of multicasts out to bunches of people, which means now we need to maintain these servers. So, and, you know, switch from a peer-to-peer connection to a one person connects to a media server, blah, blah, blah. So it gets complicated fast. And this is why, like, Zoom is a multi-billion-dollar company, because this problem is hard.
Yeah, for sure. Although it always amazes me, like, as big of a company as Zoom is and as much money as they have, like, their UX is just bad.
Isn't that weird?
When it comes to, I don't get it.
Like, I don't get it either.
I use it despite the UX. I mean,
I'm glad as a competitor that they do that.
Part of
it gave us kind of some space to run, I think. But it's surprising to me. It's like, shouldn't someone at some point take all that money and like hire like really good designers and make this thing amazing?
Yeah.
I guess they're just putting their efforts at the core functionality of the tool. And it does work well. But I mean, I think a lot of us use it.
That's a testament to how the core value proposition is just like reliable, stable video chat.
Right.
Is the important thing.
Yeah.
And to your earlier point, I'm sure part of it is that they do work on Linux, they work on Mac, they work on Windows, like iOS. So it's having to make that
to roll out a for them to roll out a new UI is not a small effort. Sure.
Okay, so I did, we didn't know it earlier, so I ended up Googling it just because I wanted to know. There is a Linux client for Zoom. which I wasn't sure of. Yeah.
Okay.
But yeah, it makes sense why they're so big is they are using a client server model, which allows them to scale up the way most of these other tools cannot, right? Like Whereby and a lot of these other things are all peer-to-peer as far as I know. Well, I think it's great that Tuple, you're eventually going to support that because for some things, like for the case that I was mentioning earlier, where it's really I want to show a bunch of people how to do this thing mm-hmm. and maybe one-on-one, you know, like obviously having them all control the other screen at the time would be silly. Mm-hmm. But that is definitely a use case I've run into. But just as a tool to allow me to connect quickly and easily with people that I am partnering with on projects, Tuple has been fantastic. Like my hat is off to you, Ben. I really have enjoyed using this product.
Thank you so much. That is so awesome to hear because it's a lot of work and it's the I think the scariest thing about starting this company was like we didn't know if we could actually do it technically. Like we had this theory that if we could make a really good pairing app, people would like it and we could make a business around it. But we really didn't know if we could. And it was like this giant question mark. And so hearing people use it and appreciate it is just like so gratifying.
Well, you're doing exactly what I recommend people do when they have an idea for a product or a startup company, which is that you focused in on one particular type of person. And you said, mm-hmm. I'm going to solve the problem for this person, this specific use case scenario, this niche. I think it's big enough that I can support a company solving the problem, but I'm going to do a really good job just here. Like we'll talk about, you know, expanding to all these crazy things down the road, but I'm going to solve this group of people's problem, right? And I think that's a great way to do it when you have a product or a startup company. And then if you need to scale it out to other markets, you can, but you've proven that it works in this use case.
Yep, totally. Well, thank you. I'm glad that a approach worked out.
No, I think it's fantastic. And I do have a bug report.
Okay. Let's hear it.
Well, I did send it in to you folks. So I don't know where it went.
Go ahead. Let it out.
You want to do it now? I was going to do it off air. Okay. We'll do it now. All right. So I use a UAD Apollo Twin for doing audio recordings like I'm doing right now on our podcast.
Yep.
And so I've got a nice microphone set up and everything runs through it. And it as a input and output device, like it has a whole bunch of tracks that go in and out. Mm-hmm. And I cannot use it with Tuple.
Yeah.
It doesn't work. The audio is garbled. I have to switch to my webcam in order for it to work.
Huh. Okay.
I think you should open a pull request.
Yeah, right. All right. This is kind of a known issue in that like external audio interfaces for some reason mm-hmm. do not work. And we don't quite know why, but the good news is the person we just hired has a bunch of expertise in this area. So this is one of the areas of the code base we want to sick him on is like our audio engine. Because
that's
audio
funny.
Stuff. It's so like there's a reason like the universal like can you hear me? I can't hear you. Yep. I can hear you. Can you hear me? Yeah. It's like such a common thing on calls. And I think it's basically like we have like 1990s sound drivers and code interacting with you know early 2000s streaming and whatnot. And it's just like it's just kind of the APIs are pretty bad and it's like hard to do audio well. And so it's
funny. So I mean, in addition to doing a screen capture product, we also did a whole bunch of audio products. I actually have a software patent. I'm not gonna publicize. Well, people are gonna.
Oh, it's a shakedown.
No, yeah, it's not a shakedown. Oh, that's a good idea. Oh, Ben, actually,
nice little business you got there. Tuple top. Yeah.
How much of a percent are you going to give me, buddy? No, not that. But so I'm familiar with. So it's actually like it's kind of a small world in terms of audio engineers in the Mac Apple ecosystem. There's a shot that I know the guy that you hired. Possible. Don't mention. Mention it on there.
Okay, sure. Yeah, he said he was okay with it. But anyway, so known issue. Unfortunately, you're a bit of an outlier in that not a lot of people are using those external interfaces. So it just hasn't quite made it to the top of the priority queue. But I apologize. Yeah. We can't use your fancy setup yet.
I'm guessing that it has to do with just that there are multiple audio tracks coming in. Uh-huh. And the tracks that the audio that it should be picking up may not be what it thinks it is.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of, you know, usually you're used to having just a right and a left. That's coming out, and here there's a right, left, and then there's like 20 other audio tracks. So, mm-hmm. anyway, I don't know, but that's my bug report. But everything else has been fantastic, and Ben, Tuple is great. I hope that this COVID-19, I hope that it ends up being something that is fortuitous for you, because I think your product is excellent. I think more people will benefit from it, whether they have to be working from home or not. But that about wraps it up for another episode of the DevMode.fm podcast. If you'd like to have every episode delivered to your favorite player, you can subscribe via RSS or find us on iTunes or Google Play. And if you like what we're doing, please review our show on iTunes. It's the best way to help others find the show. You can also follow us on Twitter at DevModeFM. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode. Leave us a comment on the DevMode.fm website where we can continue the conversation. For the DevMode.fm podcast, I'm Andrew Welch.
I'm Patrick Harrington.
I'm Jonathan Melville.
I'm Marian Nulevent. Fantastic. And you know, I actually meant to mention that you've got a podcast called The Art of Podcast. Well, we'll definitely put it in the links anyway, Ben. But
okay,
thanks for coming on. I really appreciate it. And
my pleasure. It was fun. Good chat, everyone.
Yeah. But Patrick and Jonathan, you guys don't know this, but did you know that all this time we have been talking to Marian Nulevent, and that is not her name?
What?
That is not her name. That is not her legal name. Nulevent is not her name.
I mean, now that you say it, it's not a typical last name, so.
It's a stage name.
I'm going to stop the recording right here to leave a stage name, to leave everyone in suspense.